Hello and welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick. Of course, here I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man.
I know we're both very excited. We've got a really hot show today. Joining us for a discussion is cinematographer Bobby Bukowski. Bobby's most recent films, the groundbreaking Oren Moverman drama Time Out of Mind and 99 Homes, which is the latest from acclaimed indie filmmaker Ramin Barani, are in theaters nationwide right now, and they're both deserving of everyone's time. Some of his other credits include The Messenger and Rampart, which are two more collaborations with Oren Moverman, Infinitely Polar Bear, which starred Mark Ruffalo, the mob hitman thriller The Iceman, John Stewart's political drama Rosewater, and one of our favorites, Arlington Road, which of course was directed by friend of Podcasting Them Softly's Mark Pellington. Bobby's work is always extremely stylish, and it's always in perfect harmony with the material, no matter the genre. It's an absolute honor to get a chance to speak with him today, as I know both Frank and I were really moved beyond words by Time Out of Mind, and really, really looking forward to talking to you about your work. So welcome to the show, Bobby. Thanks so much for coming on and chatting with us.
Thank you. And thanks for having me, Nick.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I want to start with Time Out of Mind because that film completely blew me away on so many different levels. It wasn't just the social commentary on the homeless, but aesthetically. When I was watching it, I had never seen anything quite like that before. And I don't know, I guess I want to know everything about the film and how you conceived the ideas of filming Richard Gere behind windows, behind doors, not necessarily focusing on him, but focusing on his surroundings. Mm-hmm. It was a brilliant way of making Richard Gere invisible.
Yeah.
In the film.
Well, it's funny because it's at a certain point of the film, you just mentioned me, mentioned it. At a certain point of the film, I was also thinking, like, I've never quite seen a film shot this way, which really excited me. And as I was shooting it, and it's funny to have that realization in the middle of doing it. But basically, Oren was very intent on shooting the city, going on, continuing life around this protagonist that Richard Gere is playing. And he didn't want to use extras, and he just wanted the city as a character in the movie, which you see prominently not only in the visuals, but certainly in the sound design too. So he presented me very early on, as he usually does, with one photograph, and it was a photograph of a New York City school photographer named Saul Leiter, and he shot in the 50s, 60s, 70s around New York, and most of his pictures were from the point of view of looking through windows, you know? So this was a key to a lot of things. A very simple conceit of the film was that was when Richard was outside, the camera would be as much as we could be inside. And when he was inside, the camera would be outside. So that there was always this separation between us, the audience, the camera, and the protagonist. A very subjective feeling of like how this character is always marginalized and is never on the same side as we are as an audience. It's a character that we're always used to seeing from afar or looking in on, but not being in the same space with. So it was interesting because from the very beginning, we said, well, we better test this idea of shooting Richard in the street. We wanted the ability to get very close to Richard, and we wanted, we were going to be very far away from him. So the first thing we decided was that we would need a very, very long zoom lens in order to facilitate this. We looked into the longest zooms, and we found out that Hawk has a 300 millimeter to 900 millimeter zoom lens, and this is a lens that is usually used, you know, maybe for like National Geographic type of like getting in close to the lions kind of lens. So we said we better test this out. So because Richard wasn't too sure that he wouldn't be recognized in the street, he was like, "Okay, it sounds like a good idea, guys, but you know, people know me, and I don't know how this is going to work. So one afternoon, we set up a camera in a Starbucks on Astor Place in New York City, and we put him just out in the street, in costume, bedraggled coat, a hat, his stubble that he had been growing, and we sat in the Starbucks with his camera, stood in the Starbucks with the camera, and we watched as nobody noticed him at all. We watched him film. We continued the shot for about 40 minutes. He started begging change. He started inhabiting this character. This is before principal photography. By the end of the shot, Richard was completely shaken. He was shaken by the idea that he, as Richard Gere, was not only not recognized, but like the character that he was about to play, was completely invisible. He said sometimes people would approach. He could make eye contact with someone very far away. But he said once you had eye contact once, eyes dropped and they never made contact again. So he really felt very palpably the life of someone living on the street that everyone ignored.
Yeah, that was certainly striking. And I wondered that, like the scenes where he is going through the garbage cans and just kind of hanging out on street corners. I honestly thought that when I was watching the film, if people were recognizing Richard Gere or if they were extras that you guys had, that makes perfect sense. And that's very cool and very startling at the same time.
Yeah, one time someone recognized him inside of we were in Grand Central Station. And one time a person just, and that person literally passed him by and said, "Hey, Richard." And that was, you know, just kept walking. So, that was the only time. And, you know, people would give him money. People would offer him food. People would give him water, whatever, you know.
And so I called the film and your work groundbreaking, and I don't use that word lightly. There are few modern films that I can think of that, feel as immersive in an expressionistic way that this film does, and it leaves one with the impression of being, like Frank said, and how you backed up, to the feeling of being invisible, of being a person, you know, marginalized by society, and the way that you envelop the audience in the sounds of the city and the voices of people passing by and, you know, just random passerby characters. It was Altman-esque at times, with the way that sound was used and the way that image was used in relationship. You don't see that oftentimes. We've been trained with modern films to expect to see people's lips moving and hearing the words coming out of their mouth, right in tandem with the shot. And you go back and watch work by Altman, and that was one of his, like, you know, trade secrets, was never to show people talking, but hearing all these disparate voices, and it creates this tableau. I wanted to ask, if that was always the intent. Was that something right up front, when you and Oren, you know, started discussing this film, and was there any of that discussion had about Altman? And
yeah, first of all, you hit it right on the nose, because Altman is a huge influence on Oren. He loves Altman, and particularly it led us to sound design in our films, but also it led us to the use of the zoom lens. It's something that we always use, the zoom lens, in every movie that we shoot together. He likes seeing visible zooms. A lot of times directors don't like seeing zooms, but Oren is a big fan. I must say that we always talk about the sound design as we're conceptualizing shots. We sit in meetings talking about shots and about the script, and he will always say, "But remember, at this point, the sound is going to be doing this," you know. So sound is always paired with the image. And that is very much influenced by Altman. Some of those passerby conversations were literally Oren on the street going out with a recorder, just walking around the streets of New York. We did a lot of our scouting. Often we don't sit in an office for this film. We were very much walking around the neighborhoods that we intended to shoot in, and then we would maybe sit down in Tompkins Square Park and start talking about, like, oh, this would be a nice place to shoot this scene, and then we would pretty much shot list in situ, you know? So
some of the sound work and some of the use of sound also reminded me, I'm not sure if you've seen the film Margaret by Kenneth Lonergan, which I feel is like obscenely underrated. And that movie sort of created a tableau of a city and the city becoming a character within the character, you know, within it, the city becoming its own character within the lives of the main characters, the human characters, which I also felt was, you know, very much the same thing going on in Time Out of Mind.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the film of Margaret, and I recently saw the director's cut too, which was even better. So I really like that film. I don't know, we didn't talk about the film at all, but I'm sure it was in our, you know, in our DNA because we both know the film.
How concerned were you guys at certain points with I'm just curious how Richard Gere became involved with this, because I've always loved Richard Gere. I've seen 95% of his work and how recognizable he is and the stigma and the clout he brings with him as an actor. But he gets put into Time Out of Mind and he's invisible. And I didn't even know that was Ben Vereen when I was watching the film.
Yeah.
I was completely blown away. I remember my mom came over because my mom loves Richard Gere, and I'm like, oh, let's watch Time Out of Mind. And she's like, okay. And my mom's never seen Richard Gere quite like that, so I think she was a little, like, distressed by the end of the movie. But she was the one that ended up telling me that was Ben Vereen, and I was like, no way. And then Kara Sedgwick's in the film, and she's unrecognizable. What kind of struggles did you guys have with that? Did you think you were going to be able to achieve it the way you did, I should say?
I think we did because, two things. Richard produced this movie, and it was the material came from Richard. It's something that he had been developing, and he enlisted Oren in directing the film. You know, they had met on the Todd Haynes film, the Bob Dylan film, and they had kept in touch, and they ran into each other about several months before we started shooting. And they said, and Richard said, well, why don't we develop this together with you directing it? So, you know, that's how that, the genesis of us getting involved with the film. We didn't really think we would have trouble with people at large recognizing the actors, because there was never a camera visible to the public, you know, like, at any point, if you went on to any of the sets, we were obliged to put signs around the actors that said if you enter this area, you are likely to be filmed because there's a camera filming this. But if you stood there at that sign and looked around, you would have no idea where a camera was. It was either in a cafe, or sometimes we were in a construction tent that we would put up on the sidewalk, and there was a little opening with which the lens was like peeking through. So there were no booms, there were no hair and makeup coming in doing touches. There was absolutely zero film footprint. So as long as we felt like as long as people weren't detecting the presence of a film set, that we'd be drawing no attention to the character.
And that this film is, you know, this is now your third film with Oren.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. And I'm sort of wondering, when you did two films before this one, are you guys now at the point where there's a shorthand where you've gotten to know each other as artists and collaborators? And, you know, because this film feels so specific and it feels so different and unique than literally 99% of everything else that's been released that I can think of in recent memory in terms of the visual aesthetic. And it's so radically different in a lot of ways than, you know, the other two collaborations that you guys have done and, you know, your work in general. Do you feel now that you guys are at that point where there's this, common shared experience thing going on between the two of you?
Yeah. I mean, very consciously, we approach films, and the first thing that Oren says is that, all right, we're about to shoot Rampart. All the things that we learned from The Messenger, let's throw them away. This film is going to ask for something different. So then we approach this film as innocence and ask ourselves, what is this film asking us to do? So same thing with Time Out of Mind. Okay, we shot those two films. Now this film is going to ask us to do something else. So that's how we approach that. Not only do Oren and I work together, but we've become dear, dear friends. And so we spend a lot of time with each other. So we spend a lot of time, family time. We spend a lot of time going to museums. We spend a lot of time just, you know, walking the streets together. So we have a lot of commonality in our personal lives, as well as our professional lives and artistic lives together. So we're very enmeshed as human beings and collaborators generally, because we genuinely really, really like each other and spend a lot of time together. So I would say that on now that since we're very close friends and very close collaborators, that there is a shorthand because we're constantly in our lives talking about everything from politics to art. So we have a common, you know, point of view on not only art, but life as well. There's so many times literally on this movie where Oren, we would do a take and then Oren would approach me and I would say, I would see like a questioning or in his eyes or a directive in his eyes. And before it even came out of his mouth, I would say, oh, I know exactly what I know what you mean. And he wouldn't even articulate it. And he would go back to the monitor and I would shoot it and he would say, oh yeah. After the take, he says, yeah, that's what I was talking about. So literally not even words sometimes, you know?
It sounds like you guys have an excellent working relationship.
It's pretty unique. Lucky me is all.
Right.
I can say is that as an artist, you really strive and look for these people that you're going to connect with. And, you know, I just think of all the great collaborations of auteurs, Bergman and Nyquist and, you know, Storaro and Bertolucci, and the list goes on and on.
I wanted to mention, because I really, really wish, and I live in Connecticut, and while we get most movies on the big screen here in one way, shape or form, whether or not it takes a few weeks or, you know, comparatively speaking to other cities, Time Out of Mind unfortunately did not show up in Connecticut movie theaters that I'm aware of, or at least anywhere near where I live. But it was made available and I believe is still available on demand. And I'm sure I'm speaking for Frank and, you know, I know myself. It's highly recommended by both of us and everyone should check it out. But what it did allow me to do is watch it twice in the span of 48 hours, because when you do the on demand, you get you can watch it as many times as you want, you know, in 2 days, which was great, because the moment it was over, I said to myself, damn, I need to see this again. And I'm a huge fan of watching movies multiple times. I feel that with any great movie or any movie that has something to say, it's never one viewing is typically not enough to distill everything. What was your first impression of seeing the film, of seeing Time Out of Mind completed, after what I would imagine it must have been a very interesting shoot, with what you've discussed with shooting from a remove and behind glass? I can't believe how many shots are through some sort of smeared light. The texture in the film is amazing. So I'm just wondering what your impression was the first time you saw it.
Oh, I was so excited. You know, I was like, I'm in the editing room, not a lot, but often, because there are things that Oren likes to bounce off of me when he's cutting. You know, he always keeps me involved, because we've spent so much time creating the movie that he's seeing how I'm reacting to certain things. I must say that Oren is definitely the kind of person who enlists people at every point of the film to elevate the film. His thing is always like, you know, everybody who is going to come onto this film is going to make the film better than I could have ever done by myself. So he really does embrace collaboration. He does expect that the collaborators to make the film better. So he very much, at the same time of having a very strong idea of what the film is, he is also very willing to hear other people's his other collaborators' reactions to the film as he goes along. Very magnanimous, generous person. It's interesting, but at the same time, a person who is completely aware every minute of what he's saying. So it's really an interesting combination of someone who's very precise, but also very open. The man, the colorist that we work with at Harbor Films in New York City is a man named Joe Galler, and he also did The Messenger with us. And I must say that a lot of our work gets done in post as well. You know, there were a lot of things in Time Out of Mind where we sat and very copiously extracted certain colors. There, you know, a lot of the theme of the movie is the assault that the city has on this main character. You certainly see it in the sound. But you also, if you look at the movie very carefully, you could see that there are certain colors that are brought out in certain moments. You know, there might be a yellow taxi cab going back, and while we apply a general saturation to most of the colors in a frame or in a shot, we might target that taxi and really boost the saturation on that car as at the same time as the sound of that car is coming up. The color of that car is also coming up. So, you know, we're working in tandem a lot with sound cues in terms of what it's going to cue to us in terms of color. In this film, because a lot of the shots are done in very, you know, single shots that last a long time, we did something in this, in the color, coloring, the grading of this film that I've never done before. And it was that we were doing dynamic changes during a shot, meaning that the color saturation might start in the beginning as being much less saturated by the end. A lighting change could happen, a density change. We might take a scene that is kind of dim and warm in the beginning of a shot, and then by the end of the shot, it is saturated and cool, so that if you grabbed frames from the beginning, middle, and end of the shot, you would see subtle differences in the color grading and the color saturation, which I had never done before, because generally you grade a shot and keep a single correction on it, but we actually used a movement of the correction as we went through scenes, which also the colorist was like, I've never done this on a film. So part of what you're recognizing as a film that doesn't feel like any other film, are as subtle as grading changes, you know?
Like Nick said earlier, we both saw 99 Homes yesterday, mm-hmm. and Nick saw it before I did, and he was all excited, and he told me how it's essentially a horror film. Mm-hmm. So that piqued my interest, and while watching it, I mean, I guess what's foremost that I wanted to ask you is, how did you decide to shoot Michael Shannon the way you did in that film? Because Michael Shannon's generally menacing, I would say, in most roles that he plays. But he, in that film, there's such a contrast with that character, because he looks soft. He's always wearing light clothing. Yeah. His hair's a little bit lighter. But he's just so menacing, and that opening shot, that tracking shot, is fantastic.
In terms of Michael Shannon, I had worked with him on The Iceman as well, you know? So I had already, like, was used to portraying him as this arch villain. And, you know, in 99 Homes, he also has this, of course, he winds up being the villain in the film as well. But from the very beginning, Ramin was talking about presenting Michael as the golden boy. The golden boy was always the cue for him. So he got tan, you know, because he's a Florida guy. He took on a tan complexion for the movie. And we were thinking about, like, Miami in a very, like, it's Orlando, the film, but we were thinking very much like, you know, that Florida kind of look in terms of wardrobe, the softening of this character. You hit it right on the head with, you know, soft linens and pastels, you know?
Yeah, that's what I loved about it, because I love Michael Shannon. I love Iceman. I've just watching the film the entire time, I'm just, you know, it's just kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's just sort of you're braced for Michael Shannon, because he just keeps getting, as you say, more villain-esque until, you know, you just realize that, oh my God, this guy's like the ultimate monster.
Yeah.
We
have the opportunity also, you know, for me, like, the thing that I always look very closely at in an actor are their eyes. You know, to me, like, it's quite cliche to say that the eyes are what tells the truth in life and as well as in film. But, you know, he has these startlingly blue eyes, Michael, and it's something that I'm always attuned to like, really bringing out. You know, Ramin was always talking about, you know, those shark eyes of Michael that just pierce, you know. So for me, lighting wise, it was always the intention to really, you know, bring those eyes out.
Yeah, I'm just like Frank. I'm a huge fan of Michael Shannon. I thought that his performance in this movie was nothing short of ferocious, and it really, really sort of just painted this picture of something that you really could believe. A guy who has just seen the blood in the water, and he's swimming around and picking up all the pieces that he can, and, you know, lining his pockets with whatever. And I find it very interesting that you had you know, two movies in the same year come out, Time Out of Mind and 99 Homes, that are both so socially relevant and topical, and they're discussing things that you know, are real issues here in our country and in the world, whatever you want. When a homeless situation is something that I've always felt that it's continuously pushed to the side, and it's one of the real tragedies of this country, in my opinion, is how homeless people are dealt with and treated. And I thought that the movie really delicately showed, and also didn't ever glamorize anything, and didn't provide any sort of, you know, false sense of hope. And sort of the same thing with 99 Homes. It's a challenging film. It talks about something that really directly affected a lot of people. You know, the housing collapse, and, you know, the people losing their homes and not being able to pay their bills. And I'm wondering, were you drawn? Was there any sort of conscious, like, connection between the two scripts? I'm not sure when both of them came across your reading pile. It's really amazing that you've worked on two films in one year that really feel so timely.
Look, I mean, generally, as you get more experienced and you have the opportunity to apply your art to something that you feel is useful, because sometimes, let's face it, it can feel quite frivolous to be an artist in a world where a lot of people are struggling day to day just to survive. So the gift of having the luxury and of being an artist is something that I don't take lightly. And so as I progress into my art, I hopefully, you know, I look for things that, okay, well, let me at least use the voice, the minutes that I have as a voice, to tell a story that is humane and applicable to human conditions. So I it's not a mistake at all. I feel like my whole career has been like pointing to this. It's interesting too, because last year at the Toronto Film Festival, I had four films, and when I looked at all of them, the other two were Rosewater and Infinitely Polar Bear. Infinitely Polar Bear is dealing with mental illness, and John Stewart's movie is dealing with, you know, freedom of expression. So they all are very humane, you know.
You're absolutely right.
So to me, it's what I'll continue to look for in my work, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. You know, you brought up those two films, and then there's The Messenger and Rampart, and, I mean, even going back to Saved, or mm-hmm. Even The Hunt for the BTK Killer, which I like. I mean, I watched that because I love Robert Forster and Greg Henry, and I was obsessed with the, I wasn't obsessed, but I was fascinated by the BTK thing when that all happened. But there seems to be like a recurring theme in your work. And I'm wondering if that's something that you look for or if it happens to just find you, whether it's being topical or, you know, even Arlington Road or a social commentary.
I think it's just what I want. It's just the way that I want to use my voice. You know, it just feels like those are the things that I want to say. I'm not, I love cinema and all its incarnations, but I must say that the thing that mostly attracts me is human drama. You know, I just like people. I'm interested in human behavior. You know, I'm less interested in spectacle than I am in the landscape of the human soul and the human mind than plot, for instance. You know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean,
action's gonna have to be action's gonna have to be dictated by character.
Yeah, and I feel like the camera too. It goes along with that. The conversations that I always have with directors, the primary conversations, are about the narrative. You know, I always like to approach my work from sitting with the director from the first day of prep and saying, okay, scene number one, why does this scene exist in the film? What is the narrative nugget of this film with which the narrative would not be complete without, you know? So let's talk about the elements from each scene that we're conveying. And now once I understand that, I can help the director express those things through the tools that I have in my bag: lighting, composition, movement, lack of movement, perspective, focus, depth of field. You know, there's just a litany of things that a camera can contribute to making a moment more poignant.
I wanted to ask, we'll skip back to 99 Homes here, because, you know, it really is one of those movies that does feel very of the moment. And I've been a huge admirer of Ramin Barani's work. I've had a chance to see the 5 features that he has as a couple, and Plastic Bag, the short that he made. And I'm just wondering how you hooked up with him and, you know, got into his, you know, brand of filmmaking.
Well, as well, as I've been a huge fan of Ramin's films. I've respected him from a distance greatly throughout his career, and each one of his films I really, really like. And I think he just, you know, he was aware of me. We were all around New York together, me, Oren, Ramin. He and Oren know each other, Ramin. And at one point he just, you know, called me and said, I'm thinking about making another film. Let's meet in Little Italy and talk about it. And we met at a little cafe and we started talking. And the first thing that I said to him, because I so much wanted to work with him, I said, Ramin, I love your films. I've seen every one of them more than once. And the only thing I've always wondered about your films when I've watched them is why the hell you haven't asked me to shoot one of them. And he said right away, he goes, well, yeah, that's exactly the way that I feel. So let's just do this together. It was the shortest conversation in an interview that I had with a director ever. We were both so intent on working with each other, you know?
Yeah, and his style has certainly progressed. I mean, like the, you know, Man Push Cart, Chop Shop, and Goodbye Solo, those 3 films sort of form, in my opinion, this little trio of, you know, I don't know what the term is, if it's like realist or neo-realist or something like that. But it's like the, you know, I said in my written piece, it's like the American response to maybe the Dardenne brothers or something like that, where you know, the stories are literally cut from something extremely relatable, and there's an honesty to the work. And it's been interesting to see his style progress with At Any Price and now into 99 Homes, where the themes are getting even bigger. The movie stars are getting bigger. People are paying more attention to the work, which I think is great. And I think that you really brought an amazing sense of, you know, of style, of subtle style to 99 Homes, in the sense that you shot the film in, I believe one of what I read was the movie was shot in New Orleans, which was doubling for Orlando, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure. Yes.
But there's always the sense that you're in Florida, and that false sense of security that the sunlight and that the nice weather in Florida provides for people, much like it does out in California. It's such a dark movie, and it ends in an ambiguously, in an ambiguous fashion in some respects. But also pointing to the failures of, and I don't want to spoil anything, but to the failures of the, you know, decisions that the characters have made. So I love the juxtaposition of the 235, you know, widescreen, sunny cinematography, this hazy quality that you brought to it. But at the same time, the material is really, it has a conviction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ramin, again, is a really, really smart person. He did great work in his previous films with a cinematographer named Michael Simmons, who is a friend of mine and is also someone who has worked with me on second camera for The Messenger, for instance. He was a B-camera cinematographer on that film with me. So he's someone that I know. And, you know, at a certain point, Ramin just wanted to test the waters with somebody else. I think what he was relying on me for and what he wanted to explore a little bit more was that he was very attracted to the way I light. You know, he was like attracted to the lighting portion of, and he also liked very much my handheld work in films like The Messenger and Rampart, which is almost solely handheld, that entire film. So he approaches things very differently, Ramin. Ramin is very intent on being very clear to me about the intentions and of the narrative. I mean, copiously so. We ride to work in the morning together. We spend all day together shooting. We sit at lunch together. We go home together in the car. We review dailies on the way home, talking about them. So he's very, very, you know, intent on having me involved in every section of this film, every piece of this film. But at the same time, when we get to the set, it's a very loose thing. You know, he blocks with the actors, and then we start, you know, shooting the film. We have ideas of certain shots, but I must say that it's a little bit more off the cuff, probably more like what I did with Oren in Rampart, where in Rampart, the first take of a shot was always the first rehearsal for the actors. We, you know, he would talk to the actors, he would talk to me, and then we would all be in the same room. I would have a camera in my hand. I will have lit the set in a 360-degree manner, which I also did in 99 Homes. And then it would just be action. And it was, you know, I was in the middle of the action, just reacting to things for the first time as they were happening, you know?
I know Frank and I are big fans of Rampart, and it's another underrated movie, a movie that should have gotten more acclaim. It should have gotten, you know, it should have had more eyeballs on it in the theater. Again, another film that gets to a timely subject, you know, the efforts of our law enforcement and how law enforcement can extend into, you know, your personal life. What was it like shooting, if you don't mind talking a little bit about Rampart, what was it like shooting that movie, in the sort of the rough and tumble fashion that you guys did?
Yeah,
because that movie has a grittiness to it that, you know, sort of harkens back to maybe some of the stuff you did in Arlington Road in some respects.
Yes. I mean, first time, for instance, that I used the Alexa, you know, Rampart was my introduction to the Alexa, which to me was such a welcome change for me. I really loved at that point in my career to have a completely new tool in my hands. You know, I had been shooting negative up until then, and it was really my first digital film. So at the same time that I was interested and excited about it, I was completely petrified by it. And I think often when you're operating from a place of newness and have a modicum of fear, it drives you in a place that is really unique, because you work really hard to make it as good as you can. And, you know, so for me, the amazing thing about that camera immediately was how easily the camera receives light, and how in low light situations this camera excels, you know. So the whole philosophy of how one lights with a camera that is rated at such a high ISO is different. So we decided at a certain point in Rampart that we were going to basically shoot the film with zero movie lights and just shoot with practical lights. So my relationship with the production designer became a very different thing, because I knew what kind of the quality and the color of light that I would want in particular scenes. And then it was just now up to me to convey that to the production designer, to say, like, in this scene, we want hard light. So can you give me a lamp that's over the table that is just open on the bottom, where I can put a clear light bulb in, and we'll have hard light. Now in this scene, I want warm light that is soft. So now, like, supply me with lamps that have shades that are warm in color and will diffuse the light that is coming out of them. I was taking practical lights, and sometimes in a single lamp would not only use the light that was emanating from the shade of a lamp, but I would add sockets to this lamp, a socket on the top the inside of the lamp and on the bottom of the inside of the shade. And I would, so now this lamp was providing me a light that was pointed towards the ceiling, which could be top light ambience, a light that was emanating from the shade, which could be side light. And then another bulb pointed to, say, out the bottom of the lamp to, say, the table that the lamp was sitting on as a bottom light. And each one of these lights were on dimmers. So at any point of the scene, I could get more top ambience, side ambience, or bottom ambience, depending on where the characters were in the scene. So when I was working on shooting this film, moving through the set with lights, my gaffer was at the monitor with remote controls on all of these lights, so that he could bring lights up and down as we were moving through the set. So if you stood at the set, you would constantly be seeing dimming cues, but in through the camera, you would never notice them, you know? So pretty dynamic way to work. I mean, because he's asking me to light the set 360, so a light that is a front light at one point might become a backlight if my camera is going 180 degrees from where that actor was to that source, you know? So that source reacts differently as a backlight than it does as a front light.
So. We always like to ask all the cinematographers we have on what your thoughts are on film versus digital.
I feel like you, whatever the story is asking you for is what you do. I feel like I wasn't one of those people that was hanging on to film. It felt like an eventuality for so long that I was prepared for it. Yes, I love the texture of film. I love the grain in film. I love the gradations of tones in film stock. But I must say that after shooting on film for, you know, close to 30 years, it was such a welcoming thing for me to have a completely new tool. Maybe it was just exciting, you know, it was just exciting to say, like, okay, now I have to figure out this piece of equipment and to be able to use, to exploit its virtues in telling a story. And for me, it's been just another adventure, you know, so I feel like I don't really bemoan the loss of shooting film. I just feel like, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever shoot another film on film, you know. And I can't really look back, and I can't say, like, well, this tool isn't good enough. I have to take the tool that's in my hands and make the best of it and exploit it. You know, I feel like, just like in film, we were always doing things like overexposing and, you know, and pulling the film, or underexposing and pushing the film, or we're flashing the film. There's always these tools that we used in film. And now I feel like I'm going through those journeys with digital that I'm looking about how low can I expose the film, how much light can I starve from the sensor and still and see what that brings. What do I do in overexposure that makes it interesting? What kind of filtration do I employ on the camera? What do I do in post? I mean, post has become such an integral part of cinematography now. You know, it's interesting how we moved from a photochemical printing of films to then generating digital intermediates on films, and then now fully embracing the digital in not only capture but in post. That intermediate of capturing on film and finishing on digital was an intermediate that was very interesting because it was a time when I started becoming very familiar with the digital tools of post. And when I moved into capturing digitally, I already had this knowledge of how, you know, how digitally to finish films. So, and I could apply that to the capture, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, we always do ask that question of all the cinematographers, and the answers are always some of the most interesting to hear because, you know, most of the guys that we've spoken to have had a chance to, you know, they grew up shooting film and have transitioned into digital. And one of the things I wanted to mention, it was funny because of just how different sometimes digital and film really can look. I was sitting in a theater yesterday that had been recently upgraded completely. Brand new screen, absolutely massive. And when I mean to tell you the pores on Laura Dern's face in some of those shots and Michael Shannon, that amazing close-up that you have of him where he's ripping that e-cigarette. I have to say the image of him with the e-cigarette is got to be one of the defining images for me as a moviegoer all year. It's a loaded image and it suggests so many different things thematically and visually. But I could not believe how crystal clear, sharp the projection was at this new theater I saw the 99 Homes in. And it, you know, my wife said on the way home, can you imagine being one of these actors or actresses where your face is that large on a screen and you can literally see into their skin? And I've always felt that one of the things with digital filmmaking is that that inherently cinematic quality that celluloid would give off, that distancing from the real world, you know, that the movie world, which I always love and I always love to feel when I'm watching a movie, that's sort of going away in some respects. I know digital is approximating the look of film better and better every day. And, you know, they're making huge advances, but I got to say, I still love the, you know, the look of film. And, you know, and we want to bring up too, I know we want to be, you know, respectful of your time, but Frank and I want to bring up Arlington Road because it was the film that we had a chance to talk to Mark about, Mark Pellington, the director, early in our podcasting career when he, you know, joined us for a chat. And that's a movie that has just lived and lived and lived throughout the years and has picked up a huge following on DVD and Blu-ray and cable and everything after, unfortunately, not finding the biggest audience in the theaters. The opening sequence of Arlington Road is still one of my favorite things I've ever seen in any movie. The intensity of Jeff Bridges coming across the kid in the street. Can you just divulge anything about what it was like to shoot Arlington Road and what it was like to do those opening bits with Jeff and everything, Jeff Bridges?
Yeah, you're talking about the very beginning with the kid walking down the street and Jeff.
Yeah. That was the first time I had seen like that. You know how film looks really fast sometimes? It looks really sped up. It's almost like they're doing something to the shutter. I'm not really sure what the technique is.
It's reducing the shutter, which we did some of. You're typically shooting at an 180-degree shutter angle, and in those scenes we were shooting at a 90-degree shutter or sometimes a 45-degree shutter. So
yeah, I love that look. I remember that it was like it got hot. I remember with like – I think Ridley Scott pulled it in Gladiator a bunch, and I remember that was like one of the first times I had sort of consciously seen that. And I also remember, you guys predated Gladiator. So it was more like I saw it for the first time there, but in any event, really stylish and just really unnerving. And I've always loved that opening.
Yeah, I mean, it was an opening. Mark and I had done another film before that. We subsequent to the first film, we did a lot of commercials and music kind of things together, videos. And the opportunity that one has as a cinematographer in commercials and videos is often to take them a little further, because they're short form and you have to stamp a style on them very quickly in a short amount of time. So they do become experimental grounds, so we're a lot of the things that we're testing out in Arlington, we're doing in Arlington Road, where we were testing out in previous videos. So some of our techniques were applied to that film. So we were using also swing shift lenses that you could vary. It's a bellows lens that you can vary the focal plane, pull the focal plane away from the camera. So it's, you could slant the focus in a way that a part of the composition is completely out of focus and something is very sharp in focus. So. Like those shots of the boys' eyes blinking and stuff like that were shot with those kind of lenses,
Love that stuff.
Yeah. Great director, too. Mark is someone who recently, we just lost touch, and then we've recently come back socially together and now talking about the eventuality of us working together again, which I would really, really welcome. It's so nice, We haven't worked together in a long time, and we've both been through major things in not only personal lives but in our careers, and I think meeting again would be really exciting.
That would be a welcome collaboration or re-collaboration, because Arlington Road's fantastic. Ooh, I'd love to see you work with Ellington again.
And God, to see, you look at the script, and the script is so good in that movie, and I feel like it was prescient in so many ways. I mean, this is like, it's crazy how this movie is prophetic in a way that we wish it wasn't these days,
Yeah, I mean, it's what, more so relevant now than maybe even when it came out?
Yeah.
Totally, totally. Try getting that movie made now. Yeah, right.
I remember they even had trouble releasing the film because at one point it was going to be released, and then Columbine, the incident at Columbine happened, and they literally a week before the film was to be released, and they pulled the release, and they started realizing that this was a film that was becoming more and more topical and didn't know how the public would receive it,
Well, we always like to ask, what are some of your personal favorite films that you've not necessarily that you've shot? You could also tell us that too. But what are some of your movies that inspired you growing up?
Oh, that's a hard thing. It's funny because I grew up in New York, and my father, we always went to movies as a child. I was born in 1952, so my experiences with cinema would have been original influences would have been 60s kind of films and early 60s kind of films. So I think the equivalent of daycare and babysitting and nannies when I was a child was going to the local cinema and sitting there for the entire day and watching the film four times in a row with your brothers during the summer when we didn't have air conditioning, and mom and dad just like, here's a dollar, go sit in the movie house all day and enjoy yourself. So those were we were always watching those scary kind of like The Tingler, or the Crawling Eye, or it was those kind of B horror films that I watched as a child. My parents would then take us to films, and my mother would always enlist me in the great, like Preston Sturges was one of her favorite directors, and she loved Ingrid Bergman, so she would take me to any movie that she was in. She liked Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, so I would see those films with my mom. She was an Orson Welles fan, so I would see those films. And my father would always take me, an ex-Marine cop from New York City, he would always take me to any kind of war movie or cowboy movie that John Wayne was in, or I would go see Bible epics with my dad, those great Bible epics in the the palaces, the cinema palaces of New York. It was interesting, you know, those Lowy theaters in New York with those beautiful old cinemas. So I must say that part of the experience of going to cinema as a child was going to this beautiful, beautiful place, these palaces, you know, of chandeliers and gold and velvet, and looking up at the ceiling and seeing these paintings of skies. So there was always this awe. That the only other time I had a similar awe was going to church. And so it's interesting how both those places, a cathedral and a cinema, as a child, were equated to me. So, like, the cinema had this very spiritual kind of connotation to me just by the virtue of the architecture. So I think I applied awe to cinema at a very early age, you know?
Yeah, I can relate to you with my dad's a Vietnam veteran, and all my childhood was spent watching John Wayne movies and you know, The Longest Day.
Yes, yes.
And you know, a lot of those big sweeping epic war films and stuff like that. So very cool, man. Yeah. That's very cool. I hear you.
Sergio Leone films, my dad would like, you know, all those Clint Eastwood films here.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a fantastic chat.
Thank you so much for me as well.
This has been great. And just as a reminder to everyone that Time Out of Mind should still be on demand, and if it's not, see it. Just buy the Blu-ray when it comes out. And then go see 99 Holmes in theaters.
Nice to talk to you guys. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Bobby. And we'll be looking forward to your... You got some stuff on the horizon. You're working on a new movie right now, and we'll be looking forward to seeing more of your work coming up.
Yeah, please keep your eye out. And Oren and I are starting a movie in the winter, so that's another one that you should be looking for.
We certainly will.
And I noticed something. That did you just work with John Michael McDonough?
Yes, that was a blast. It was really good director of comedy, you know, a very dark comedy. Which stylistically is a divergence from a lot of my work, very bold colors and more high-key type of lighting, and a lot more flat in a certain way, or maybe a better way to say that is a very graphic depiction of a world. And I'm just color grading that now, and I'm really, really excited about it. Good, great director, you know?
Yeah, his previous film Calvary was a real scorcher. So I can't wait to see more from him. And yeah, this has just been a fantastic chat, as I figured it would be. Your work is amazing, and you know, just it was just a pleasure to hear you talk about it. And thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Thank you, Nick.